keep in mind that at the right after the, we talked about the third step, where we talked about launched out in a course of vigorous action, right? So now here we go, right? Up until this point, the book hasn't given us necessarily a lot to do, but now there's some actions to take that are seriously designed to change our attitudes, right? Seriously designed to change our attitudes. If you look in the Big Book Awakening book, on page 57, and actually on 56 as well, is another example. This is like a guide sheet for an inventory. And I'm just going to run through some of this. Now, what you're used to seeing is people making a chart with four columns, right? Book never actually refers to columns. But if you have to have columns, you can turn the book sideways and draw the lines this way, because here's the first, would be the first column, the second column, and the third column, okay? But it's, rather than writing across in little columns, if you just write across like that, it makes a little bit more sense. So at the top, you'll see a little line at the top of this guide sheet. That's where I put the number of the resentment and the letter of the resentment, because I got this list of people that I'm resentful at. And A, I was resentful at this. B, I was resentful at that. C, I was resentful at that. And I listed the causes of my resentments. So I just keep a note of that at the top. And then the first line says, I'm resentful at, and then I put the name of the person, right? Oh, notice that at the top there's a prayer. God, please help me see the truth about my resentments, right? I consider that every time I start writing a page. And also next to where it says, I'm resentful at, notice it says reference page 62, example. That's where it talks about making a list of names of people we're resentful at. Next to each one of these columns, it'll refer to where the instruction in the book comes from, right? So if you have any doubt that it's not right out of the big book, then just refer to those pages, right, for what the book says. So I put the person's name at the top, and then the cause of the resentment. I write why, what the resentment was for, what the cause of the resentment is. You know, and then the book talks about seven areas of self, right? And the seven areas of self are self-esteem, pride, ambition, security, personal relations, sex relations, and pocketbook. Right? So what we found is that each one of those is affected by every resentment. Right? So this is a good reason why you need to be realistic when you're helping somebody through this. And if they've made this enormous first column list, right, if you're not realistic, there could be way too much work. And what I found is that if I have a list of the main resentments, right, and to look over and to examine this way, I can experience a lot of movement in my attitude in each one of these. If I've got way these, like this guy, like I mentioned, the guy with 2,000 names in the first column, he never finished. He created this wall that once he got the rest of the instructions, he couldn't surmount it. It was just too much. But his ego didn't want to shorten it. He had stuff in there that could have easily been grouped, but he refused to do it. Anyway, so I'm going to give you some explanations about these things, and the step three and step four are in the same chapter in the big book. There's no, like, necessarily, it didn't switch chapters. It goes from the example of the actor trying to run the whole show and to later on, right after the fears, with a comment that, about being in the world to play the role that he assigns, right? So to play on that idea, Bill's using, is really... been really dependent on this idea that we're the actor trying to run the whole show and play God, right? To use that to help explain this is, after I've put the name of the person in this first line, the cause of the resentment in the second, then I examine each one of these areas of self. You could see the line on the to the right of it, that where it says fear of being, right? If you look on page 67, beginning of the fear inventory, it says, notice the word fear is bracketed alongside the difficulties, right? And that's where the instructions to bracket those fears alongside the difficulties comes from. You see, self-esteem, pride, ambition, security, personal relations, sex relations, pocketbook, those aren't my difficulties. Those are good things. Those are what I need to get back, right? But some people will look at this chart on page 65 and say, well, this is the fourth step, isn't it? Because it says we're usually as definite as this example, doesn't it? Doesn't it say that? And their inventories look a lot just like this little piece here with little check boxes next to it, which, you know, I've done those before and it helped, but it didn't take me to where this took me for, because there's pages and pages of information after that that's part of the inventory, right? And even below this chart here on 65, it says, we went back through our lives, nothing counted but thoroughness and honesty, and when we were finished, and I look at that as when we were finished with Mr. Brown, column one, A, B, and C, column two, the causes, and how it affects my life, the seven areas of self, when we were finished, we considered it carefully. And there's two ways you consider it, naturally. One would be in your mind, and the other way would be in paper. And this is a written inventory. So some people call this an extended third column. And I write out how each one of these were affected, right? And as I said, I was going to go along with Bill's theory about the director trying to run the whole show. I'm the actor trying to run the whole show. See, self-esteem, that's the role I've assigned myself in my little play. And I kind of pull myself out of the situation like a third person. Like, I'm sitting over there next to Brian, looking at Dan up here on the stage, looking at you guys, right? Did you follow that? In other words, I try to take myself out of my own position here and just look at myself. And I look at what's the role I've assigned myself here. And I start the sentence off with I am, right? You know, maybe it'd be, I am Mr. AA. That's the role I've assigned myself, right? That might sound arrogant, right? Well, it is. It is an arrogant statement, but but I mean, think about this. If you were the director and you are casting yourself as you were the person sitting here on this table, right? Wouldn't you assign yourself the role as being the person who's supposed to know? Right? So with that, though, I'm supposed to look at my fear in connection with that. So next to I am Mr. AA, I let the third column reveal the fear to me. And the fear is that maybe I'm not. Maybe I'm not good enough. And that's what I write next to it. Right? You know, and you might write various fears, whatever comes to you, but maybe it's, maybe I'm not good enough. Maybe I don't really know. Right? Now, pride is the role I've assigned you guys out there and how you're supposed to look at me. Right? You know, and it's going to start off with either others should or no one should. I don't put your name in anywhere in here because this is my inventory. Right? You know, so it's either others should or no one should or others can. Right? So the role I've assigned you is others can see how much I know about the 12 steps, right? Again, that might sound arrogant, but remember we're trying to, obviously I wouldn't be standing here if I didn't have some idea that I'm supposed to know something about this, right? And none of you here wants to get up here and talk about something that you don't have any idea that you know, about, that you don't want to talk about anything that you have an idea that you don't know something about it, right? And you would like to be sitting up here with all of these people staring at you, thinking that you were giving them something, right? So the role I've assigned you guys here in my little play is others can see how well I know the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, right? So the fear in connection with that would be the opposite of that, right? Fear is that maybe you don't see that. Maybe you have a different opinion, a different judgment. Maybe you think I'm full of it, right? So the fear next to that is that maybe you're judging me as not knowing, right? And that's what gets written down next to this. My ambition is what I want to happen here on the stage, right? And I start that with I want. You know, I want everybody to agree with what I say. And sometimes there could be more things that you could write, not just one. Maybe, you know, I want everyone to worship what I say here as everything there is. And again, maybe the fear is that you don't agree with me, that you don't like what I say. And I write that stuff down in the fear columns, right? Security is what I need to happen here in this, in my little play, for me to be okay with it, right? You know, and maybe it would sound something like, I need you guys to really approve of what I say up here to be okay. You know, and maybe the fear is that you don't really agree with what I say or approve of what I say up here. Okay. In my personal relations, the personal relations I look at as the deep-seated ideas that I have about what this relationship is supposed to look like. Not what it should look like, but what it's supposed to look like. Right? Because remember, I'm the director. And I'm casting my little play here. Obviously, I have an idea of how interactions are supposed to look. Mothers treat their sons like this. Right? Brothers treat their brothers like this. Right? Right? And maybe in this case, it's AA members tolerant of the speakers, you know, or other AA members don't judge other AA members' talks, right? So maybe the fear is that's all you guys are doing is judging this, right? I don't know if you could relate to that. But. And sex relations. Keep in mind there's a whole other sex inventory, right? So rather than have it overlap, what turned out to be helpful is to look at sex relations as me, as a man. You know, what do I believe, what is my deep-seated belief of what a real man is supposed to do here? Or what is a real man is supposed to be up here, right? You know, real men command the respect of their peers, right? Or real men are not judged, not that they don't know what they're talking about, right? So that maybe the fear is not respected, right? Or the fear of being judged, right? That's how I look at sex relations in this form. And then pocketbook. Some people like to look at the idea of the value that they've put on something, and I don't know that that completely goes along with what the big book is talking about. So if this is not about money, then I just skip it altogether. And I go through this, and if you turn to page 61 in the workbook, some people actually will print this out and print the other one on the back side of it. And if you go to the website, actually, there's a, you can print them off the, you know, the actual pages off the, you can download a PDF file of this. I don't necessarily agree that people should use this. I like it. I like to encourage people to write it on just regular paper. That way you don't have to have the right utensils to write inventory, because you never know when you're going to have to write inventory. You don't want to have to say, well, I can't do it till I get back and pick up the instructions, right? And I think you can get dependent on the instructions being right there. So, but I still, I've, if you have a problem keeping the focus, it's better to keep the focus than to, and have the instructions, than to worry about whether or not you're doing it perfectly. So I get all this down, and there's a part in the book on the bottom of page 66, right, where it says we turn back to the list, for it held the key to our future. Right. I've made this list, the first column list, and the cause of my resentments, and I've gone through all of the third columns, attaching the fears next to the difficulties in the extended third column. And now it says we turn back to the list, for it held the key to my future. We were prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle. We began to see that the world and its people had really dominated us. In that state, the wrongdoings of others, fancied or real, had power to actually kill. How could we escape? We saw that these resentments must be mastered, but how? We cannot wish them away any more than alcohol. So what it says here, paraphrasing it, is the key to my future is being in a place where I can master my resentments. What a promise, right? To be in a place where I can master my resentments. Goes on to say, well, this was our course. We realized that the people who wronged us were perhaps spiritually sick. Though we did not like their symptoms and the way they disturbed us, they, like ourselves, were sick too. I know that some people will get to this point and then they'll stop and they'll pray for the other person's spiritual sickness. And I don't go along with that, only because I'm sitting here writing an inventory, a personal inventory, about me and my resentments, and in the middle I'm going to pray for your spiritual sickness, as if it's like the whole thing is because you're spiritually sick. And I think what I read here is that they are spiritually sick like I am, and I have to see that it's like I am. And in pondering that, it's like, okay, well, what do they mean? How would I know that they're spiritually sick like I am? So you see the instruction on page 61 of the workbook. It says, how have I done the things I've resented in column 2 to the person or persons I've listed in column 1 and or others? Right? So remember, the inventory was about... I actually didn't talk about the first two columns, did we? I just put my name in the self-esteem. So if it was about me speaking here, the resentment would be towards you, your judgment, right? You guys and your judgment towards me, right? So the realization is, how have I done the things in column 2 to the people in column 1? Have I judged you? Maybe we shouldn't really talk about that right now. Obviously, I've had judgments of what you were going to think about me. I've had judgments. Have I ever been in your situation and judged people sitting here? Absolutely. Have I ever sat out there in a seat like you are and looked up at the speaker and said, where does he get that stuff from? And I don't remember reading that in the big book. Have I done that? And it's like, yeah, all the time. So I see that the things that I didn't like about you were the things that I find objectionable about myself. Right? And what a realization to have is that hey, I'm spiritually sick like you are. Right? And that somehow when you see that you're just like what you're writing about, it goes on to talk about granting somebody tolerance, pity, and patience that you would cheerfully grant a sick friend. You know, if I was sitting out there watching me, would I want the person sitting up here to be tolerant, to grant me tolerance, pity, and patience, right? If it was obvious that I was sitting in judgment, how would I like that person to treat me, right? So it's starting to shift my attitude. Remember in page 62, talked about selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. And all through the third column, I've listed my selfish and self-centered false notions. Right? And now I saw how it was driven by fears, and now here it's going to be my self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity that it talks about in that paragraph. We're going to start to look at that, and it's starting to change my attitude and helping me. Because when I see that you're, the things that I have seen in you are in the first two columns, and I see that those are the things that I find objectionable about myself, it's easier for me to find tolerance, pity, and patience, right? So my attitude is starting to shift, right? So that when it brings me to the point in the book where it talks about referring to, and this is actually in 67, in the middle of 67, referring to our list again, putting out of our minds the wrongs others had done, we resolutely looked for our own mistakes. Where had we been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened? Though our situations had not been entirely our fault, we tried to disregard the other persons involved entirely. Right? This is my inventory, not yours. Right? So, on this page 61 of the workbook, it shows self-seeking, selfish, dishonest, and afraid. Self-seeking and selfish are different in the sense that self-seeking is my actions. Right? Now, I got the difference of these two actually from one of the people I was working with. He was actually going to school in UCLA for a doctorate in research psychology. And we were going through the book, and we get to this point, and he was really good with definitions because he was like an encyclopedia, and it's built into his head. And I said, how would you define the difference between self-seeking and selfishness? And he said, you know, it's funny you should ask, because I just went through a class at UCLA called Self-Seeking and Selfishness. So I thought, great. You know, so we started to talk about the difference. And self-seeking is my selfish actions or activity. What did I do? Right? Selfishness is my attitude, my selfish attitude, the thinking that I had while I was doing those things. So in the first part here, next to self-seeking, I look over that other page that I just finished, the first three columns, and the realization. And I asked myself, what were the selfish actions or activities that I've done here? Right? And I list whatever comes to my mind. Right? And then next to the selfishness, I asked myself, what was I thinking while I did those things? And then it talks about the dishonesty. And the dishonesty that I believe it's talking about here is my self-delusions, the lies I've told myself. What were the lies I was telling myself in that thinking that I just wrote about? Right? And then the next part is fears. And this is a little different than what's written here. Sometimes when you put things on paper and you decide you like something better, you get stuck because it's already in print. You know, but what I've been currently doing is asking myself, what were the fears underneath the dishonesty and the selfish thinking underneath the actions I was taking? And it just kind of pulls you down into this place and leaves you with the fears underneath it all. And at the bottom of that little guide sheet, it says harm. And I look around the harm that I've, around the person in step one, their family, their friends, who else did I affect? And I write that down here. And I do this for every person on my list. Right, every person in that first column list. And it's not the easiest inventory, but I've done a lot of them. You know, those of you that were here earlier heard that I said I had 6 sponsors in my first year. The first one gave me an autobiographical inventory to do, to write down everything that I know about step one, then everything I thought about step two, then everything I thought about step three, then what I thought about step four. And all I could do was write everything that was already in my mind, and it was just like a dump of everything, of a lot of information that I already knew about. There was nothing new. Felt good writing it, and I felt like I accomplished something because I got some instructions and I did them. But there was no change that occurred through that. It was just pages and pages of information that was already in my mind. The next sponsor gave me was Hazleton pamphlets. You know, and I answered the questions that applied, and I skipped the ones that I felt didn't apply. Again, didn't do what this does. Right? Next person that gave me a 4th step to do gave me the ones with the check boxes, and that was better than the previous ones. But you know, checking the boxes that applied didn't encourage me to concentrate or consider what all this stuff meant. Right? And I did certainly feel really good by finishing it, you know, and I certainly stayed sober through it, but I couldn't say that there was a shift in my attitude towards these people. Right? And I keep bringing up the word attitude. I'll come back to that. If I forget to come back to it, remind me. The point here is that if I do any inventory that's not in the big book, and any work that's not in the big book, how can I ever expect to get the promises that are in the big book if I don't do what tells me to do prior to those things? And that was my experience, that any work that I did that couldn't be aligned with what the book tells me to do could never and hadn't ever taken me to what the book said I was going to go. That was my experience. When I did this process, as outlined in the book, as I moved forward and the book told me what I was supposed to get from it, those things happened. Right? Okay, I talked about coming back to the idea of attitude. Now, with an attitude for an airplane, you know, they have an altimeter, and tells the pilot the attitude of the plane, which is which direction the plane is leaning. My attitude towards God in the second step was as I was leaning towards self, primarily, and away from the idea that a God could work in my life. Right? Here in the 4th step, I have an attitude towards blaming other people for the condition of my life, right? Rather than leaning towards the idea that maybe there's something in the way that I'm processing this stuff that is bringing me to a place and that I don't know what to do with it, so I react with fear. So what I see, and this goes back to that paragraph on 62 where the resentment is driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. I start to see that the fears set up a condition that drives the thinking in the third column. If I look at the third, if I didn't have the fears next to the third column, then when column one does column two, I'd be neutral. Even though my thinking was trained to think a certain direction, if I'm not in fear about those things, I won't react to them. So you're not going to understand this before you write this. It'll come later. But the idea here is to be moved to a place of neutrality so that resentment doesn't take me like it always has, right? So the next thing here is a fear inventory, and we don't really have time to go through that, but there it is here. And I have to see that underneath all of this stuff, there was fear connected with it. There is a little exercise that is laid out here in the book as far as what to do with fears. And there's also a point that I'd like to talk about here on this in 67, where it says, perhaps there's a better way. We think so. If we are now on a different basis, the basis of trusting and relying upon God, we trust infinite God rather than our finite selves. We are in the world to play the role that He assigns. And as I see all through the inventory process that I've been in the world assigning roles, expecting you to be a certain way and me to be a certain way and situations to be a certain way. Just to the extent as we do as we think He would have us and humbly rely on Him, does He enable us to match calamity with serenity? And what a promise that is, to be able to match calamity with serenity. It doesn't say I won't experience calamity, but that I'll be able to match it with serenity. It says we never apologize to anyone for depending upon our Creator. We can laugh at those who think spirituality is the way of weakness. Paradoxically, it is the way of strength. The verdict of the ages is that faith means courage. And one of my favorite lines in the whole book, here on page 68, is all men of faith have courage. It doesn't say they don't have fear. It says men of faith have courage. Okay. They trust their God. We never apologize for God. Instead, we let Him demonstrate through us what He can do. We ask Him to remove our fear and direct our attention to what He would have us be. At once, we commence to outgrow fear. And that's a great prayer there. God, please remove my fear and direct my attention to what You would have me be. It doesn't say what You would have me do. It says what You would have me be. Right? And it also talks about commencing to outgrow fear. And I don't take that like I'll never have fear again. I take that to mean is when I have fear, there's a way to outgrow it by turning to and accessing that power that I got from this process from God. And now there's another part of this inventory. It's the sex inventory. And the sex inventory happens to be on page 69. So, and I don't know if they did that on purpose. You know, they may have. Because I'm sure Bill had a sense of humor. Now, to me, the sex inventory is not about sex, but my conduct in sex relations. Right? If I don't see my behavior in my relationships, I'm doomed to repeat them over and over and over. And there's some specific questions here on page 69. In the middle it says, we reviewed our own conduct over the years past. Where had we been selfish, dishonest, or inconsiderate? Whom had we hurt? There's 9 things on that. And if you turn to the workbook to page, 69 and 70. Hey, it worked out to 69 in this too. Yeah, I actually just I actually just put the numbers in and I didn't plan it. Now, so on page 70, you'll see the nine questions that it poses in this paragraph. On the first page, where there were some questions that will really help when you're reading your fifth step to your sponsor. And it basically says, write a brief history of the relationship. Put the name at the top in the relationship. First of is, what was my motives for getting involved? Right. Then my specific conduct in the relationship has been. Then the major points that came up in the relationship are, and how it ended, or how is it now? Now, although this isn't in the book, it will certainly paint a little picture for whoever's listening to your inventory to be able to more effectively listen to your responses to the nine questions, which are on the next page of the workbook. Where had I been selfish? Where had I been dishonest? Where had I been inconsiderate? Whom had I hurt? And I look around around the relationship. Maybe I hurt her family. Did I arouse jealousy? Did I arouse suspicion? And did I arouse bitterness? And where was I at fault? And one of the most important questions here is this next question. It's what should I have done instead? Now, what comes to a lot of people's mind is, shouldn't have gotten involved in the first place. Right? That's the easiest way to avoid the right answer. And the easiest way to avoid seeing what you need to see in an inventory that's supposed to help you see your conduct in a relationship. Right? What should I have done instead in the relationship? Right. And I say that that's real important because there's a part after this that talks about a sex ideal. After I've listed all of the people that I've had a relationship with, sex relations with, and wrote this on each one of them individually, then however many people I've written on, I've got a what should I have done instead for each one of them. Right? And that becomes an ideal for my future sex relationships. Right? Because it talks about here on page 69, in this way we tried to shape a sane and sound ideal for our future sex life. We subjected each relationship to the test. Right? Was it selfish or not? We asked God to mold our ideals and help us to live up to them. We remembered always that our sex powers were God-given and therefore good, neither to be used lightly or selfishly, nor to be despised or loathed. So I write that sex ideal out in prayer form. And it's based, again, I'm just repeating this, it's based, again, on all of the combined, after reading all of the combined question nines, right? That should give me an idea of what should I have done in each relationship, and you'll find that it's probably not a lot of different things. There's probably some consistent things, some consistent part of your behavior that happened in each relationship. Remember, there was only one consistent thing in each of these relationships that I had, and that was me, right? So when I see my behavior and the parts that I find objectionable, right, about my behavior, if I can turn to a power and ask that I can grow beyond my old behavior in relationships, what would that do for future relationships? Right? And at the bottom of this, we always look at the harms, any specific harms, and make little notes of it here. All right, so those are the different parts of the inventory. And the summary of the whole inventory process is on the bottom of 70, where it says, if we have been thorough, page 70 of the big book, If we have been thorough about our personal inventory, we have written down a lot. We have listed and analyzed our resentments. We have began to comprehend their futility and their fatality. We have commenced to see their terrible destructiveness. We have begun to learn tolerance, patience, and goodwill towards all men, even our enemies. For we look on them as sick people, like myself. We have listed the people we have hurt by our conduct and are willing to straighten out the past if we can. So, that takes us to step five. After we've done all this stuff and did this solitary self-appraisal, the book tells me that that's not by itself enough, and that it's important to read that to somebody else. And I'm specifically trying to get something here, right? And on page 72, which is the beginning of the fifth step, it tells you exactly what you were trying to get through this inventory process. It says, having made our personal inventory, what shall we do about it? We have been trying to get a new attitude, a new relationship with our Creator, and to discover the obstacles in our path. Right? We have admitted certain defects. We have ascertained in a rough way what the trouble is. We have put our finger on the weak items in our personal inventory. Now these are about to be cast out. Right? Cast out. Right? And this requires action on our part, which when completed will mean that we have admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our defects. And this brings us to the fifth step in the program of recovery mentioned in the preceding chapters. So, it's mentioned the word defects a couple times in this paragraph. Right? I think it's really important naturally to read this to someone you trust, but I think it's also important to read it to someone who understands the process and what you're supposed to be getting out of it. I actually don't listen to fifth steps from people that I don't work with. I may listen to them if it's somebody that at least does it in a similar fashion. Because when I listen to someone that I understand their fifth step, I know if they're writing it right. I know if they weren't. I know if they've missed something. I know if they've got the point. And I approach it a certain way that's consistent with this process. And part of what's consistent with it is knowing what's coming up. Because remember, we're leading up into 6 and 7. And while I'm listening to the inventory, I'm listening to it. Is the inventory focused? Do they sound like they know what they're writing about? Does it sound like they're still resentful at this person, or if they really seen their part? There's some good instructions in 76 in the sixth step where it talks about admitting the things that we see as objectionable, right? Or are they clinging to something they won't let go of, right? Or are they willing to turn to God with help with this stuff? Those are really good directions for while you're listening to somebody read an inventory to them. Are they clinging to the resentment? Do they see where playing God in the situation was not a good thing, right? That self-reliance has failed them here, right? Is there things about the inventory that they can see as objectionable, right? And while we're discussing those things, I don't have them write down character defects while we're listening to the fifth steps. Labeling is something that just kind of throws me off. I can have a list of things that I can perceive as character defects, and if I want to categorize them, they would all fall under selfishness, self-seeking, dishonesty, or fear. Right? And nowhere in the book does it say that I'm going to be able to work on these things. Right? So what I do though, do when I'm listening to this is, can you see what you what the defect in your behavior is in this particular situation, and do you see that as objectionable? Right. Obviously, if their behavior is objectionable to me and they don't see that, then there's a little bit more to talk about, you know. But you know, I mean, I'm talking about in situations where they're hurting people and they don't see that as okay, as not being as that being not okay. Anyway, as with the rest of this, we both pray going into it and ask for the intuition to know what has to come out in our conversation in the fifth step. And it can take a while, right? And the book here doesn't necessarily say that you read this to one person. It says we think well before we choose the person or persons with whom we take this intimate and confidential step. One of the popular things in my home group is to do multiple fifth steps. Where you'll pick, I think the first time I did a multiple fifth step was I was told to pick 7 people to read it to separately. Since then, to get back of them, I came up with the idea of picking 6 people and sit down with them all together, right? Right, that way they have fun with you and they can sit in the, and it makes it a little bit more interesting because now you got a group of people and they're all focused on you and what they can do to what they can come up with what you said, right? You know, the more you do this, the more you have to find ways to play with this to keep it interesting and fresh and new. So initially, the first time, just pick someone you trust and don't worry about all the rest of the stuff, right? But afterwards, you know, the inventories should be hopefully smaller, right? So doing a multiple inventory or doing it with a group of people that are listening to what you have to say, you know, can mix it up a little bit and make things a little bit more interesting. So what this says, though, here is they stress in this paragraph and into action that we have to be ready to be completely honest with somebody, right? And that holding anything back, you know, where does it say that? Hang on 1 second here. We pocket our pride and go to it, illuminating every twist of character, every dark cranny of the past. Once we've taken the step, withholding nothing, we are delighted. We can look the world in the eye. We can be alone at perfect peace and ease, or fears fall from us. We begin to feel the nearness of our Creator. We may have had certain spiritual beliefs, but now we begin to have a spiritual experience. The feeling that the drink problem has disappeared will often come strongly. We feel we're on the broad highway, walking hand in hand with the Spirit of the universe. Nowhere does the book say that the road narrows. Right. Here it tells me that we're on the broad highway walking hand in hand with the Spirit of the universe. So after I did my first inventory with my sponsor, he asked me, is there anything else that I need to tell him before I leave? And there was the little list that I kept in the very back of the book that was never going to, what the book calls, see the light of day. Okay. The situations that took up space in my head that I was very ashamed of. And I wasn't ready to reveal that to anybody. And he asked me, is there anything else that I need to tell him? And I lied. I told him everything. I said, there's nothing left. So he said, okay, and he gave me some instructions, which is on the bottom of 75, where it says, returning home, we find a place where we can be quiet for an hour. Right? And I believe that this is where the sixth step starts. Before it says you're at any particular step, there's a paragraph lead-in all the way through the book. So a lot of people will look at the sixth step as being just that one paragraph. I believe that if you look at each step and how it reviews what you've done so far and then tells you're at that step, that would mean that all things being consistent, sixth step starts at returning home. We find a place where we can be quiet for an hour, carefully reviewing what we have done. We thank God from the bottom of our heart that we know him better. Taking this book down from the shelf, we turn to the page which contains the 12 steps. Carefully reading the first five proposals, we asked, have we omitted anything? For we're building an arch through which we shall walk, a free man at last. Remember the arch we were building in the third step, right? Through which we'll walk, free men? But this thing was still eating away at me because I knew I had my little list in the back here, you know, and I couldn't, reading this, I couldn't honestly say that I was did it 100%. It says, have we omitted anything? All right? And I had omitted things. So I called Joe up and I says, hey, you know, I wasn't 100% honest with you. I have this list, this stuff in the back of the book that I haven't shared with you. And he says, okay, we have to get together again. So we got together and I shared with him the rest of the stuff. And then I went back and went back to this paragraph. I don't know how much that mattered, but by this time I had so much movement in my life, I trusted what these people were telling me. Right? Everything they told me I was going to get, I got so far. Right? And I didn't want a chance half measuring any of this. Right? They hadn't lied to me yet. Goes on to say, is our work solid so far? Are the stones properly in place? Right? The foundation stone, cornerstone, keystone. Have we skimped on the cement put into the foundation? Talked about the cement on page 17. The powerful cement which binds us is a combination of our fellowship, the common solution, and our common problem. I'm sorry, the fellowship, the common problem, and our common solution in this book. So skimping on the cement which binds us would be, am I only going to meetings, not doing enough of the step work? Am I just doing step work and not bothering going to meetings anymore? Have I tried to make mortar without sand? Right. If any of you know how they mix cement, how they make mortar, cement is much weaker if you just straight cement, so they mix sand or rocks in with it to strengthen it. So when they say, have you tried to make mortar without sand, right? Is there a part of this program that I'm not doing, right? I've seen a lot of people get so involved in the step process thinking that this is much all they really need to do and they don't need to bother with those meetings, right? I have to buy the whole program, right? Meetings by themselves won't keep me sober, right? The steps outlined in this book, they're just words, right? You know, I do them. I've seen people do them and not stay sober, right? The working with others, it doesn't matter how many people you work with. I've seen people that have worked with hundreds and hundreds of people go out and drink. These things do not keep me sober. But practicing the whole deal brings my life to a place that's conducive to staying sober. And it's that whole thing that brought me, that I depend on it, you know, going to meetings and meeting new people, you know, continuing going through the process myself to grow spiritually and to work with others to solidify what I know and to also to grow spiritually. Right. If I can, so on the next page on 76, it says, if I can answer to my satisfaction, I then look at step six. Right. And again, I don't make a list here. I incorporate looking at the things that it tells me to look at here and while in the fifth step, and I encourage people when they go home on their own to examine the fifth step on their own. It says, we have emphasized willingness to being indispensable. Are we now ready to let God remove from us all the things which I have admitted are objectionable? Right? So I go back all through the inventory and look at every page. What do I find objectionable about this interaction? What about this interaction? What's objectionable about this interaction? And I pull out the nature of my character defects, right? Making a list of my character defects is kind of like listing all the drinks that I like to drink, right? I'm not an alcoholic because I drank beer, Jack Daniels, and Jose Cuervo, right? Listing the drinks is not what made me an alcoholic. Listing my character defects is not necessarily the nature of my character defects, right? Which it talks about in the fifth step. What is the nature of my defects? Right. So visualizing my behavior in each one of these situations, I have a contemplative kind of pass through my life and my defects in action. Right. And admitting the things that I find objectionable, can he now take them all, everyone? Right? Am I willing to turn to God for help with every single one of these? Am I still clinging to something I won't let go of? Resentment, behavior, whatever? Right? If there's anything that I can say I'm not willing to let go of, or things I find objectionable that I don't believe that he can help me with, right? I ask God to help me be willing. Right? And I sit with that. Right? And I was told to just sit with that until I was completely ready to turn to God with all of this stuff that I've seen. Not just from the inventory process, by the way. Wasn't my alcoholism in some ways a defective part of my nature? My agnosticism in step two, a part that's so ingrained in me, and I consider at this point that agnosticism is a defect in my nature, right? And in step three, my reliance on self-will, right? Can't get away from relying on self-will, right? Can't that be considered some defect in my nature, right? Certainly in relationship to someone who wants to be on a spiritual path, right? Because by this time, I've started to feel some freedom. By this time, I've started to feel some power from the process. By this time, I'm starting to know there's something here that I don't 100% understand, right? So they say that step six is only one paragraph, but when you incorporate that paragraph beforehand and examine the first five proposals, right, makes it much bigger. It's time for a break right now, and we will come back at 4:45 in 15 minutes.